I'm your host, Mr. James, and you are listening to Right in the Schoolies. My next guest was most famous for his appearance on the 2015 UK edition of The Apprentice. He made the final three, something that not many people achieve. And while he didn't win the whole thing, he now runs a business in which he helps small revenue companies become big players. I'm very lucky that I know him through my local rugby club, and he agreed to sit down with me and talk about his educational experience here in the heart of Surrey. It's Richard Woods, everybody. I'll start off and say... this is the perfect time. We'll probably get sued if I use the Apprentice theme music.
You'll be fine.
Yeah.
I use it all the time.
I was going to say I'll have Sugar turn up at my door and...
Could you direct him my way?
he will have got lost with the Amstrad product probably, but we'll see. Anyway... Richard, we're here to talk about your days at school. So if you'd be so kind, could you start off getting straight in? Tell us, which school did you go to? When did you go there? And what do you remember about it?
It's kind of a bit of a blend of the two. Started off education straight into the private school, Hallgrove in Windlesham, or Bagshot, Windlesham in Surrey. Great school, loved it. Sent my son there as well, which will be quite an interesting thing to loop back on. Had many happy years there until I was politely asked to leave, which again I'm sure you'll loop back on. I went to Collingwood College, which was the big kind of state school in Surrey, had a reputation at that point. I don't think I enhanced the reputation. So went there, left there, kind of went into college for about 99, around 2000, and then on to uni after that. So that's kind of been my checkered past. I'm 38 now, so I don't know, you can do the maths. Whatever the normal education is. Oh, strangely enough, I did an extra year at Collingwood as well.
Okay.
For various reasons as well.
It's always nice to know actually what a school looks like. I drive past Collingwood pretty much every day on my way into work. So for people that aren't from this part of Surrey, and it's really just down the road, you're much more of a local boy than me. Can you tell us a little bit about the stark contrast in a place like Collingwood and Hallgrove? What would you say are the two most obvious differences?
Just strangely, I think probably the plots that these schools are on are very similar. I mean, Collingwood is a vast school. I mean, it's just from year 7 to year 11, you're talking about multiple classes of 30 in each class, within a year group. You're talking about thousands of kids. And it's set within one of the biggest council estates in...
I believe it's the Old Dean, yes.
The Old Dean, which has an eyebrow raise if you do it. And look, it is very much... I mean, I remember going in there with my sort of plummy private school accent in year 7 and the first day and kids trying to make the names. It's the sort of school where kids make a name for themselves. So remember the first day there was this chat, I won't name him, but you know when you can remember people's names even when you think back now. And he was, he basically went around sort of smacking people on their first day in the years above to prove that he was a rough, tough year 7 or the rest of it. And I just think, Jesus, where have I landed myself into? And of course there was girls there as well, which Joe was quite a delight for a bloke who'd just come from an all boys school.
Year were you in when you made the transfer?
Yes, year 7. So
oh, okay.
I had to. So it goes up to year 8 in.
Gotcha.
As you probably know, in the private schools, you then do the common entrance and all that sort of fun stuff. And so I left a year early in Hallgrove, and then worked across to Collingwood and. Baptism of fire when I first went there. But to be honest with you, it's one of those things that I will never ever regret, because I feel so much more rounded and so much. But I know people that carried on in the private system. Don't get me wrong, my kids are in the private system at the moment. They probably will go all the way through, unless they're not allowed to. but some of them have. there's an element of being worldly, and I think the private system has to have more worldly education to kind of ground kids in some instance. I can even see it now. I mean, Milo's only 7, there's some strange, very eyebrow raising comments coming from his friends about social economic issues, etc. And you're thinking, Jesus, man, you're 7 and you're referring to people as being, you know, the poor people and stuff like that, which I was like, this is really horrible. God, we're going deep in this already, Joe.
Like, great.
I'm going to sound like a right wanker by the end of this. Excuse my friend.
What I think is really fascinating, actually, is you've already touched on a few things that I think are ripe for conversation. Because unlike yourself, I've never been schooled in the private sector, but I have worked in there. And I feel like one of the things that makes my experience as an educator a bit different is that I was schooled in the state system. I've worked in the state system. I currently still do, but I had a couple of years trying it out in the private sector with limited, you could probably say with zero success, actually. But what you said about how being worldly, being seen to be worldly, and having sort of, well, some would call it pretensions, others would say aspirations, depending on where you look. It's very interesting, because I do think that a lot of the biggest differences between private school kids and some of the very bright state school kids that I teach, they are almost identical. It's just that one group of them is far more confident than the other.
Degrees of confidence, yeah. Do you know what, Joe? Honestly, when I look around, so Miley goes to Hallgrove now, and Poppy, my daughter, goes to Cowarth Park, which is traditionally it was a all girls school in Windlesham. It's mixed. They're both mixed now, but one's kind of a more friendly school, Cowarth, and then Hallgrove's more like a sports rough, tough kind of thing, and they are co-ed, but. The co-ed means mixed, right?
Yeah.
Co-ed. I don't know the lingo, you see, Joe. I'm trying to get into your lingo of the podcast.
Our American audiences will know exactly what you mean. We tend to say mixed.
Mixed, right. So they've got both boys and girls in both schools. But they still have this legacy of being very much like a more nurturing school in Cowarth, which is why for Poppy, who definitely, you know, would appreciate that side of things. That's why we tend to there and to Milo going into Hallgrove. But the facilities are amazing. Mm. The stuff that they do and just the opportunities that they have, the sporting, you know, just the tease, right? This is the thing that actually makes me laugh, because I was saying to my wife, Cara, who grew up in Ireland, educated in Ireland all the way through in a convent school, really strict school, etc. They barely played any sport.
Sounds like she'd make a great guest on this podcast.
Yeah, she probably would. but the tease that you have, I was like, God, you probably don't realise this, but next year when Milo starts doing away matches and cricket and all the rest of it, that they have tees. And she was like, what do you mean by tees? And she's like, yeah, if you go to a rugby game afterwards, they host these tees, which is like a tea party where they do scones and cakes and stuff for the parents. And you sit there around and eating sandwiches, waiting for the kids to kind of get changed and come back to take him home. It's this whole weird thing that happens.
I put on half a stone when I worked in the private sector from dinners, puddings, things which I wouldn't ordinarily, and you mentioned about the away matches and stuff. So we took the kids to places like Shiplake College, Herodians, Hampton, some of these places which made our school, which was independent, like with a small I really, whereas some of these were big P private schools, one of which was the school that Gary Barlow sends his lad nice. To. I was reffing a rugby game, would you believe, in which is summer play. So Gary Barlow's on the touchline and he goes, how long we got left? And I bottled it. I was going to shout, Gary, have a little patience, mate. I couldn't do it. It was there for the taking.
Yeah, should have done.
I'll go to my grave thinking I should have done it. Should have done it. Anyway. You sort of said it earlier on about the facilities, obviously things being much nicer. Collingwood, from what I know of it, is, like you say, very sporty, very big. But obviously, I can imagine it being the kind of school where, like you say, behaviour might have been a bit interesting. Now, how did you find that when it came to fitting in? Was it a bit like prison? Did you have to sort of, you know, prove that you were tough to start off? Did you find your people?
Yeah,
in the
you,
end?
You have to scare it down. I mean, it's got quite a reputation. Some girl the year that we joined got stabbed in the eye with a fork in the dog.
Yes. I heard about this. Yeah.
Yeah. And we were there and we were like, wow. And then she's outside. Of course, she's smoking a fag by the ice cream truck that's outside the school gates the next day, like eyeing everybody up, going,
well, maybe not eyeing everybody up, but yeah.
Well, no. Well, she's all right. She had both her eyes. It's the one that there. And
So
she's been expelled or told not to come in. And she's then like scowling at everybody from the outside and in the ice cream jar. But it was just weird, you know. It was also an amazing experience. So because you've got so many students, right, I was part of some of the productions. I got into the kind of theatre stuff there. And Mrs. Roberts, who's an amazing teacher, I know you're going to ask about a great teacher. She is one of the shining lights of Collingwood. She put on this great production. She production every year, always every year. And they also did like a sixth form review as well, which was kind of a cabaret type thing for the sixth form. And then there was also the main production each year, which was an entire school thing. So she would do like Blues Brothers or Grease or, you know, whatever these big productions were. So I was part of Grease and I did that one. And I was Kinnicky in Grease. I was one of the guys.
But so you got to sing Grease Lightning.
Oh, I did get to sing Grease Lightning. Very true.
I was also in my school's production of Grease. I lost out on the part of Kinnicky to a certain bastard who happens to still be one of my best friends. But, you know, typecast as always. So,
well, I wanted to be Danny, but I couldn't sing. So they made me Kinnicky and then they told me you've got to sing. I was like, come on. but yeah, so it was huge amounts of kids and great, you know, production, big theatres and stuff they had at Collingwood, and even to the extent that they went to the fire station, which is right next door to Collingwood, and asked the firemen to cut the roof off of the car to make it look like the T-Birds kind of big car thing. And we drove this car, we took all the engine and everything out, and we drove it on stage during the production to actually, you know, with headlights on and everything to sing Grease Lightning on the top of it. It was amazing to be able to put that much effort and kind of show on. And you could do that because of the volume and the size of the school and actually kind of the will of some of the amazing people there to do a lot with just a little. You know, they may have lots of people, but they've definitely got limited resources. So look, it was a great, great school. And, you know, I ended up being rugby captain there. I ended up really enjoying my time there. I kind of settled into the flow of it. I felt I was always... Yeah, massively dyslexic. So I was always behind. I was getting pulled out of lessons. I was all part of the, you know, we call it the yellow sticker club, where you get a little yellow sticker on top of your exam papers to say that this person has got, you know, special dyslexia needs or whatever. It probably shouldn't be allowed nowadays. I don't know what the rules are for that, but I had more time in the exams. I even got, when I went to university, they gave me an MP3 player. This is going to date me. Not an MP3, a mini disc player record lectures. So it was a mini disc player. You get a free mini disc player with the whatever incentive the government would do at that point, if you're dyslexic, to record lectures. So I had all that kind of weird struggle through it. Collingwood had some decent extra facilities for that, again, because of the size, so that you could actually put that sort of stuff on. Whereas I think Hall Grove was a little bit late to the game. But then again, we're talking about the 80s here. So they didn't have, I said the 80s, yeah, 80s for Hall Grove, latter part of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. So dyslexia and the support anyway in the education system probably wasn't that as good as it is now. Collingwood was just good at the big things, but you can easily get lost in there. You know, classes are 30 and you get big disruptive kids, so sort of, you know, kind of big characters, quiet characters get overshone easily. People that do well because they have the set streams and the different gradings and stuff, but you can just find yourself just getting lost further and further behind. And the teachers are overwhelmed. There's too many kids. And if you're not, you know, an absolute A-star performing teacher, you know, that actually can hold a room like that, which is an art and a half, you struggle. I remember plenty of French teachers. I don't know why it's always the French teachers, but the French teacher would be running out crying because of, you know, a couple of the chaps who were in our class and were throwing chairs around and stuff. And it was a game to try and make the French teacher cry. And that's kind of Collingwood all over it. Whereas in Hall Grove, it's a race to put the apple on the front of the French teacher's desk. So it's kind of the different. But yeah, you know, yeah. So that's kind of the differences between it, or my experience anyway.
There's two things. There's expectations of students, as in what expectations they have of themselves. In, like you say, some of these students, I imagine, had very little regard for something like learning French. Their response would be, why on earth would I need to learn that? Whereas, of course, switch to another sector, they're going on skiing holidays,
yep,
to Val d'Isère, all of this kind of stuff. Suddenly, you know, that value that gets placed on education is different. And it's such a bloody shame that money has to change hands in some instances for that to be the case. And this is always the debate, which I think is a very good one to have, which is, you know, why can we not be more values rich as a culture? You know, if you look in parts of the world, they might be very, very economically poor, but their values about education are incredibly high because they know it's a ticket out of poverty and difficulty. Whereas I think I don't know how, but it's certainly the same for us, same in America, same in parts of Canada, you know, speaking to friends there, there is a cycle of people who decide, especially people who have kids, who they go, well, I didn't like education. And in some cases, the kid then ends up not liking education, and so on and so forth. And you find plenty of people willing to be agents of good change. But when you meet people who don't care, it does take, like you say, a pretty superhuman effort from a teacher or a school coordinating to make that different.
But what's your thoughts on this, Joe? Because I know that you're asking me the questions, but I'm going to ask you a question. So you see a lot of this kind of TEDx talks around, you know, the education system's broken, and everybody loves to say the same thing. Is that very famous talk about how, you know, there's either the introverted learner, which is one sort of TED talk, or you've got someone like myself, a dyslexic learner who just thinks completely differently and is never really going to be able to perform within the parameters of the structure of the education system. What do you think when people start to say that to you?
I completely agree with them. I think that our education system, and by our, I am speaking about pretty much the entire Western world here and parts of the Eastern world. I have a time teaching in the Far East. I know some of the stuff which gets coveted over here, things like PISA scores, like in maths and sort of computing and stuff. You know, I was teaching in South Korea where those things are through the roof, you know, like attainment is so high. But then you have to sacrifice things like quality of life, young people feeling utterly, utterly pressured into staying up all hours of the night to study. And then to bring it back to the idea of what you were saying, you know, to be dyslexic or dyspraxic or dyscalculia or, you know, or autistic to the point that it would affect certain things, or ADHD. It's that old quote, isn't it? You know, everyone is different. And if you were to judge a goldfish by its ability to climb a tree, you'd assume that the goldfish was an idiot. You know, that sense of everybody has different strengths. And one thing that I think is that the idea of the comprehensive school is a very noble one. It's to say, let's try and get everybody into education and find out what they know and what they can do. And the concept of the comprehensive school is pretty new still. It was only started, really. They had these things called ragged schools in Victorian times, where you sent the kids who were unable to do the manual labor in the mills or in the workhouse or anything. So like, well, I guess we better give them some sort of education. It was basically child abuse and child labor. What was my point? My point is, I totally think it's valid. And I don't think any good teacher looks at what we're doing every day and goes, well, this is perfect. In fact, I think if you do look at it every day, I think that you're a dullard, because there's so many things we could be doing, but we are bound and shackled by people like Mr. Williamson, who I'm not sure has ever had an original thought in his life. And unfortunately, cross-party, regardless of politics, I think that I don't know why you have education ministers who've had zero experience in the sector of their own. That could go for all. But the fact we accept that is pretty shameful, I think.
I don't know. I've got a different opinion on. I mean, that we're about to go deep diving on political things, but there is is really tough politics, right? So politicians, everybody forgets that the skill is to be a politician. And I'm not sticking up for them, right? So nobody's stupid enough to actually stick up for them. But the skill is actually to be a politician. And what does a politician do? They've got to take bills and they've got to get them passed through the House to be able to make change in the direction that the party wants to take in. If you're the party in charge, that's great. If you're party who's in opposition, it's to try and make sure that you're holding the party in charge of the counter for it, right? So all of that is a job. That's a skill set. So people get attracted to that skill set and do that skill set. Now, the fact is that in the education minister, he will have a directive from the party and say, this is kind of the direction we want to go. But then he will have experts who are not skilled at being politicians. They are skilled at being experts in the education system. And then they will have that meeting and that kind of that thought brain tank that will then be informing the politician of where to go. Then the politician's skill is to hoover that all up and actually let these people know that you've got to be realistic because it's never going to happen because the Treasury is doing this and this, the army wants to do this and the bloody, you know, the civil service want to do this. But we could probably do a bit of that and a bit of that, and we can kind of call that together. And then that person goes, this is the idea that we're going to do on the education. And we're like, you're an idiot. You've never worked in education. You're, you know, and so it's basically, but then the skill is from them is to, they actually then just kind of have Teflon and go, well, fine, you know, you can call me an idiot all you want, but you know, I'm going to do that. And then I'm going to sleep with my secretary and I'm going to do this and this. And, you know, I'll be politicianly. And
what
then,
a life,
and
then eh?
They go through. and that's the point. And I think a lot of people, and I know we're completely going on a little bit of a tangent here, but I think the art of politicianness is actually totally transferable between being head of, you know, the, you know, environmental policy, and then next week you can be head of you know, the military, because actually it's about letting the experts inform the direction but keeping it on party political track. And so,
well, in that case he needs to sack all of his experts because they're feeding him some pretty terrible information if that is the case.
You are yeah. Right, so there you go. So therefore it's then down to who's the experts and who chooses.
And this would bring to answer a little bit more of your question as to when do I look at things and go, yeah, I agree or I don't agree about education being broken. I think that Ofsted or any regulatory body have stopped being what they were intended, which was as a watchdog. And everything should have a watchdog or some sort of, you know, oversight. It has to be there for everything. Otherwise, people, you know, I think people need to know, especially when it comes to things like safety, especially with kids, child protection, all of that. But I think that the minute that Ofsted became basically an arm of the DfE and they basically became the thing that could be used to threaten schools with all sorts of things, the tail starts wagging the dog quite quickly, I think, because head teachers, and I know some bloody great head teachers, and, you know, I've worked with some really good ones. I currently work with a really good head teacher. A lot of the time, these guys have got the same workload in many ways and same ability and skills that they have to be able to do as some CEOs. And they do take home, in some of the big multi-academy trusts, they do take home a sizable amount of money in comparison to regular on-the-floor teachers. But they're
nowhere near the same as CEOs.
Well, no, not at all. And this is where I think it gets really difficult to untangle all of that, because we're so far gone. You know, league tables are a thing. The fact that we have a private school system that isn't subject to the same checks. I mean, you can't even Ofsted a private school, for example. You know, they have their own independent schools inspectorate. And I'm not saying they're a lighter touch, but they are. And, you know, the independent schools inspectorate are just a very different body. And it's this status quo of, well, we've always had schools like this and they've always produced ministers typically like this. And so there's a bit of me that gets kind of tired of being told what we should be doing by people that maybe have those skill sets, like you say, but they've not actually even been in these schools as a pupil, as a person. And sometimes you just find yourself listening and going, well, we're fighting every single day for that room of kids right in front of us. And that's all you can do. You know, that group of 30 kids, you are right. Some of them are going to be missed. Some of them are going to, especially in COVID. COVID has been the worst agent of showing social disparity for what it is. You know, I teach in a relatively leafy state school up near the M4. It's very, very, you know, in comparison to some of the other schools, you know, you look at the schools in Reading, some of them are pretty, pretty tough. You know, this is a nice school with mostly nice kids, with mostly, you know, like I say, leafy suburban stuff going on. And yet the amount of social, mental, emotional health things we've had to deal with just this year alone, and all of that, it doesn't bear thinking about in some of the schools where the sociological aspects of that is far worse. People have gone through bereavement, all of that. All you can do is focus on the class right in front of you, because they're the one that really count. That's my only way that I can see it going on, which might also be why I'm getting more and more grey hairs around here, you see, as it goes day to day.
So this is the interesting thing, and I take that point, because I know that, you know, I've been a pupil in those classrooms, so I'm fortunate to have done, you know, well enough to kind of stick the kids through private school. Will continue to do so. And because I know that, you know, Poppy, who you know, has been diagnosed with similar stuff to what I was diagnosed with, etc. She's only young, but she wants to do different stuff, and they want to foster that creativity in her, or help her, to give her more time to do this, or even just more on a general point to the facility. You know, as we talked about the facilities before, but the small class sizes and then the breakout classes. Remember, it's a teaching assistant and a teacher within a class of 12. Like, that's pretty full on. You kind of actually don't think about that. It's not just a teacher. There's two of them there. I don't know what the ratios are this year the other way. And then they have these little breakout areas where they do these different things, etc. And I just think that's the best chance of someone who might, you know, we're all individuals. So some people be great at maths, other people be great at English, other people be great at everything, you know, all rounders. Yeah.
God, I hate people like that.
Yeah, I know. And then you'll have, you know, the sporty ones, or you have the creative arty ones, etc. And the skill is to spot that and to foster it. And the less kind of noise around, less people to have to kind of get to know, the quicker it is that you're going to spot those little intricacies of their talent as they start to grow.
I completely agree.
The quicker it is that you double down on it. When I've done well at school, I've doubled down on art. I doubled down on the performing side of arts. I really love business, but I was crap at writing. I was really good at debate. And so I just kind of excelled when those moments arose. But then hit really crap GCSEs and really crap A levels. Had to redo my final year of A levels, so I failed exams, couldn't get into any university. Redid those and go in, and it's like, you know, in business, I'm failing business exams, and you know, I go out to be an entrepreneur. Why did I fail business exams? Because it was a written test. You know, it's not. And when there was, you know, I got a first for my dissertation at university, which was entitled "Is There a Link Between Dyslexia and Entrepreneurship?" And published that, and it was kind of put in the library. It was a really you know, important piece for me, and it was the start of my kind of love of creative thinking and writing. Now, the thing was bloody, like, if you went through with you know, spell check, it was living red pen all over it. But luckily, you know, I got my mum to completely spell check it beforehand and just change a few things about paragraph wise, and you know, it read well then. After I got all the ideas on paper, and so hence why you kind of get, you know, decent grades for these things, and that's because it's not the ideas that is the problem, and it's not the depth of your thinking that's the problem. It's the putting it on paper that's always been a problem. And part of that thesis was around how people with dyslexia, going back years, you know, would be the guys down the docks doing the deals, and the wheelers and the dealers, and you know, the guy, you know, even kind of back into sort of more recent memory in the turn of the century, you had the guy who designed the Sydney Opera House, was massively dyslexic, and some of his work people were looking at, like, you know, couldn't understand anything for Toffee when he was drawing it. But in his mind, he unpeeled an orange and saw the acoustic advantage of the peel of an orange, flattened off, and then that became the Sydney Opera House. And that kind of was all fathomed in his brain. He just thought a bit differently about something, and then bam.
I did not know that. That's I like to say every day is a school day, but it is literally for me, unfortunately.
Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah, some of them. You know what? As well, what I really enjoyed about what you were saying there, Rich, was that there is this very sad hangover that some people still have about dyslexia meaning just one thing. Would you mind describing a little bit what it looks like for you? Because some people say that when they it's obviously a spectrum. Some people see words sort of like dancing or wiggling around a little bit. Others say that they read a block of text, but then don't actually retain any information. Others say they can read perfectly fine, sit and read something. And the minute they go down to write, they look down at what they've written. They've gone, I've completely moved that word from there to there when I didn't mean to. And I'm just intrigued because I don't often get the chance to ask.
I don't really answer this question in that way, because I like to actually say about how dyslexia is a superpower. And actually I like to talk about all the positives around it. Because like looking that and the reading and stuff and rest of it, like most people can read, you know, Cara reads 5 books in a week. This is my wife. A week away on holiday, she'll go through 5 books. I'll read one, but I read it. Like I go through every single word because that's the pace that I read it. And I only take business books out and I'll have a pen with me and I usually underline a few things and stuff. And that's because I have to. I can't read 5 books. I actually physically cannot read 5 books in a week. I just would not be able to do it. My superpower is that I read slowly, right? So why do you want to read fast anyway? I read slowly. I read absolutely every single word the author has written. And I take it, I hoover it in, and I retain knowledge in my brain. Like, you wouldn't believe it, because I take the time over less. Less is more in my world than it's always been, because I couldn't do the cramming. You know, I failed all my exams because at the end of the day, I tried to cram like everybody else did at the end. But the people that crammed that stayed up all night, they would read the whole textbook. I got through the first bloody page and kind of gave up, right? So it's half my fault that I got bad grades. Of course, it's all my fault, of course. No one's doing it for me, right? But that superpower is important. It's important to understand that. And when you think creatively, like when we're doing maths, I couldn't do maths in the same way people do. When people say, how do you add up, etc., you know, if I actually walk people through how I'm adding things up, I'm adding them up very strangely in my head. But it's just because I have to work in blocks of 10, and then I go, you know, 10, 10, 10, 10, 10, or whatever, and then I'll remove the little bits from the tens, and then I have what's left, or, you know, which isn't the normal way. I don't know. I can't even think about the right way, but that's kind of the only way I can do stuff. And so that's how I do it, you know? And I think that's the same for everybody else. Just because someone's been taught, this is the point with dyslexia. As soon as dyslexics realize that they've got a superpower, but as soon as you find your little hack on how you can do it your way, and you have that little smug feeling that you've hacked the system, and yes, you got to the same number without using their way, that's when the superpower comes in, because that's when you start questioning everything. You question the whole freaking world. And when you're an entrepreneur and you come out, and we haven't spoken about what I do, you know, my business and stuff like that, but I hustle in small businesses. I help businesses go from some revenue to a million in revenue. I do that small business piece. And that's because I love finding people and businesses out there that find something different to do, a little bit of innovation, a little bit of something new about packaging something up differently, presenting something differently, hacking the norm to make yourself stand out. And that's what I had to do when I was in education. I had to hack the norm to make myself stand out, or even just make myself the same level as everybody else. And then finally, when I got my moment to shine, which is when someone might stick me on a stage production, we were talking beforehand about, and I just loved it. It was like, wow, God, Richard just entered the room. Like, you know, and I was like, whoa, that was amazing. Like, I can do that bit. And actually people thought I was good at that. Shit, I've hacked my bit. And then suddenly I found the bit where it applied, you know, the little bit of standing out, it applied to when we were doing the stage production, or it applied to when we were trying to problem solve or debate. I remember a history lesson where I'm struggling because I actually got kicked out of history. It was part of the reason why I did 3 years at college, because history I failed and the history teacher get on with me. But I remember debating about the Arab-Israeli conflict, and then suddenly, you know, getting into a position where I'm having this kind of heated debate within the class, and like knocking over people's debates really easily. I think, fuck, I've got all this knowledge. And I was reciting stuff that had obviously been said in the lessons and throwing it back at people, but I couldn't write that down. I can't think of that and then write it down, but get me into debate and bam, 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 I'm away. And so that's the superpower. And sometimes you just got to simplify. It's almost like how Apple was so successful. They just simplified everything and made it nice and clean and easy. Once you can make your own brain as clean and simple as Apple, you don't have to have all these other things going on. You just, less is so much more. And then you go deep. I always say that there's more gold beneath you than is around you. Don't go pan for gold in lots of different streams trying to find little nuggets. Deep down on your skill set, and you'll find that ravine of gold that is the superpower. It doesn't matter what issue that you might have or superpower you might have.
You've given me now at least four fantastic lines to use for your epigraph, by the way. The one about gold's excellent. The idea of hacking into an idea and yeah, I think what I really love about the subject that I teach and what I really hate about the subject that I teach, and these two things have to exist in a coexisting thing for me, is that it's really hard when you get creative individuals in your room who you know have got it all there and they are trying to pass an exam which gives nothing towards that, and you have to try and help them unclog that bit that goes from here to here. And when you manage to make it happen, or rather when they manage to make it happen with hopefully the right things in place and the right encouragement, it's a lovely feeling. But very, very rarely does it happen all the time. And there are so many very creative people. We've got a nice big thing on our wall in our English classroom, the one I share with somebody. And it's got famous and successful people who are dyslexic. And lots of them, you know, and there are some, you've got plenty of musicians, actors, you've got entrepreneurs as well. I'm pretty certain Lord Sugar is
Lord Sugar, yeah, is one. Richard Branson
chefs, too. Yeah,
Jamie Oliver,
absolutely. And this is the thing, is that you are so right. Wear it like a badge of honor and say, no, this is my superpower, this is how I do things, just a little bit differently. And I think we're going, it's funny, dyslexia is, dare I say it, it's slightly less of a big deal these days anymore. People just own it in a way. Autism spectrum is becoming a bit more like that, because we're learning
exactly
more.
The same way,
we're learning more about it, and I really hope that it does become down there. And as a practitioner, I am trying every single day to learn more about these things so I can help. But it's so hard.
You know, really, really interesting points. So I was talking to a guy who does training, like talking about like proper corporate training for huge corporate blue chip companies, and he went into a pitch, and they said to him, "So what's your thoughts around diversity and policy around that?" And he says, "The biggest problem with diversity is everybody thinks about color." And he says, "I don't think about color at all. Doesn't matter. It's not a representation at all about a workforce. I think about brains." So when we talk about diversity, I want to actually offer a way of you being able to tap into different brains. Doesn't matter what that brain is inside. Doesn't matter what color, gender, sexual preference that brain is inside. It's the brains that you want to have a diversity from. You want to have people on the autistic spectrum. You want them in your programming. You want them problem solving. You want to have people who are creatively solving stuff that are in different types of brain. You also want to have different personality types that are actually, everybody says, oh, we need, this is the one that I hate the most. We need more women on the board to hold the men accountable for it. I was like, that's terrible. Like, that's just so polarizingly like awful in its own phrase that you would say, oh, women are there to hold men account. Like, fucking, could you imagine how awful a statement that is? And how many, you know, how you could break apart that statement in so many ways, right? It's actually, you need different personality types to hold the different personality types of hair. So if someone's really like, in a personality type or a type of brain that's like really list focused and has to do that, really pushes their ideas around, you have people that draw back in a little bit more considerate of other people around it and actually consider the bigger picture and the wider stuff. It's that is important. It doesn't matter, you know, what shell happens to wrap that personality and that brain around. And I just thought it was a really interesting thing. And I'm really pleased that those conversations are being had both in the boardroom as well as the classroom. Yeah. And the more we can have that, the better.
There's not a huge amount of difference between the boardroom and the classroom, I don't think, really, especially I'm a committed apprentice watcher, and I have been for years. And certainly some of the squabbles in the boardroom, you wouldn't allow in most secondary school classrooms. They've certainly got some venom. Now, we'll come back to that briefly, but I did want to, if it's okay, ask a little bit about what was it that got you kicked out of the private school and meant that you had to go and spend your days in exile in Collingwood.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's not my proudest moment.
Okay,
I got many of them, but it was a ski trip, as you were almost commenting on, and we did a ski tip to Gstaad when we were at school, and it was just like a good lovely little thing. Can't remember where it was. Anyway, somewhere in Switzerland, and of course you know. Back then, you go, well, you go to Switzerland, right? So what two things that Switzerland does, right? Chocolate and army knives. And so when we went on the school trip, we're like, well, we'll go off and go get a pen knife, a Swiss army knife. Yeah, that'd be great. So whatever happened, the teachers, and we were young, right? But for whatever reason, teachers would just let us kids just go ramble around in this Swiss town, right? This is kind of, you know, when...
This was the 90s, I assume.
This is like classic 90s. Just go on, kids, go make yourself busy in this place. We're probably going to pop into the pub and have a few beers and we'll see you back in a few hours, right? And so anyway, we'd gone piling off to go get chocolate and Swiss army knives. And so we picked up our chocolate and jumped into this place and got it. And of course, I'm there going, I've got pocket money. I want to go blow all my pocket money. So I was like, I want the biggest knife you can find because, you know, I'm telling you. So it was, how old are you in year six?
You'll be about 11 years old. 10 to 11.
So 10 to 11 years old, on a ski trip away, probably away from my parents on holiday for the first time. And had some spending money that dad had given me, and it was enough to get a big knife. So I've not got a Swiss army knife. I was like, can I have that massive freaking sheath knife on the wall, please? And it was a combat knife, a black sheath. I remember it really well. I was gutted because obviously I got it later you realize why it was taken away from me. And on it, it had one of those little compasses on it and had a little blade sharp. Oh, it's freaking massive combat. I'm talking like it's a huge thing. And I've had that. Well, that's great. And of course, we kind of suspected I probably wasn't allowed that, so I kind of concealed it on the way back to the chalet, and we're chatting. Anyway, it transpires that that's fine. We're having a bit of fun. I go, well, where's my comic gone? Someone's nicked my comic. Do you remember Citadel Miniatures, like the Games Workshop paint those?
Yeah, Citadel Warhammer. Right?
Warhammer 40k, yeah. Exactly. So someone, the White Dwarf was the publication, yes, that came out monthly, and someone had nicked my White Dwarf, and this was kind of hot property because you know, there's only a few of them rolling around. I happen to have mine. This chap, let's call him Matthew, had nicked my bloody White Dwarf, and he wouldn't give it back to me. So I've gone piling in to bundle my magazine off him, and just happened to then kind of, you know, have the knife thing. Now, don't get me wrong, right? I'm not going to stab him. This story doesn't end in blood. Okay.
I'm very tense.
I've walked in, I've gone and pinned to the bed with this huge freaking knife in my hand. And of course, headmaster walks in through the fucking dorm at the time. And I like, frozen with this huge knife in her hand, him pinned to the floor. And headmaster comes piling in, and of course I was politely, you know, kind of sectioned off into my own room for a while and told to calm down, and then promptly asked to leave the school.
I can imagine that the first thing that went into his head, if I know any head teacher, that he'll have gone, this wasn't on the risk assessment. Shit.
Risk assessment back then. Are you kidding me?
True, the 90s, yeah. Like, no such thing.
It wasn't even a thing. It was quite sad, really, because actually my brother, who was a year below me on the same school trip, was kind of a little bit also, you know, it was kind of nodded that maybe Tim should probably follow me off to the other school then. And we both kind of subsequently left Hallgrove after that. It wasn't expelled. It was you should probably change schools at the end of this term.
There's quite a lot of that in the private sector. I don't think it's too much name dropping, but because it was before my time of teaching there, so I don't think it's that indiscreet. But Didier Drogba's lad came to the school that I was at apparently at one point, and he got, funnily enough, a similar story. He found an EpiPen, I think it was, and went round jabbing people with it for a laugh. And of course, you know, I think he got through quite a few. Yeah, he got quite, yeah. So he had these really insulined up kids who didn't need it, you know.
That's so bad.
And he was summarily sort of called in. And apparently Didier himself came and was very understanding. He was like, yeah, no, we get it. They're like, yeah, you might want to find another school for him next year. There's quite a lot of that off-rolling that can do, because they're paying customers. I guess it makes sense, really.
Well, yeah, they're paying customers, but also it's not, it's the rumor mill, right? So, Dangerous Woods is running around with a knife on school. And of course, it's not the school's fault, it's my fault. And, you know, the fact that everybody there was tooled up as if they were sort of, you know, out for a night out in, you know, East London. Everybody's kind of rolling back in with these knives. But of course, yeah, for sure, he's terrible at this. Did you hear about the knife thing? And, you know, so of course, then as long as I leave, then it's the majority of the paying customers they want to keep. They don't want to have a big mass exodus because of it. So that it's that basically. It's
you just, could have done your street cred a world of good though as you arrived in Collingwood. They're like, it's Rich the Knife.
Mate, that was the entrance criteria. Have you had a knife related incident? Good, welcome, welcome in. Yeah, you'll do well here, my friend. Bad, but honestly, it is really bad. It's one of those. I mean, if I think, in all honesty, and I know it wouldn't happen now because the kids would never be allowed to just go off and buy stuff, you know, and they knew that people had bought Swiss Army knives. They did know, but it was Boy Scout stuff, right? So it's kind of like, you know, if that had happened now and that was Milo getting pinned to the ground by another boy with enough of that, I'd be flipping, going, losing my rag. I'd be going mental. And there's no, you know, I it's just not on. So actually you put yourself in the other shoes, you just think, wow, yeah, it was a bad scenario. So anyway. The right decision was made. I left.
I haven't prepped you for this question, but on a totally different note, and I like to do this without any prompting because the reactions are more genuine. You mentioned that there were girls at this new school when you went to Collingwood. Were there any awkward teenage crushes that you're willing to divulge?
I just think everyone, like when you go from an all boys school to there being girls, it's like there's just unreal. It's like, you know, finding yourself in Woolworths in the pick and mix section and, you know, your mum goes, make yourself busy for 5 minutes. You're like, what? So I didn't wait long anyway. It was just actually, to be honest with you, it was strange because you don't actually end up talking to many girls because, of course, all your weekends are, you know, with your friends and the rest of it, you know, and your mates are all blokes and rest of it. So it's just, there was that whole kind of, you know, actually talking to girls and to have to go through that experience at like 11, 12 of not really conversing with the opposite sex is, you know, not something that I would want for my kids as well. So
do you think it's better though that people actually are able to do that at school all the way through? And then by the time they become an adult, because I did know guys when I went to university, suddenly I'm 18 years old. I've been at school with girls. Not that any of them would go out with me, but you know, the point is I knew that they were there. I knew that they were human beings like me, but my friends who I met who went to all boys schools, geez, you know, it was like they're on another planet. They're just going, what's going on?
And the boarding.
Oh yeah, of course.
The boys are boarding. There's an all girls school called Farnborough Hill. When we were at Collingwood, it was always to try and get invited to the Farnborough Hill girls party.
Oh, I see.
It's an all girls school. And of course, they're the parties you want to go to when you're like outnumbered 4-1 girls to guys and they're all from a girls only school. Those were the invitations.
Now, you've already mentioned your drama teacher. Were there any teachers that you really thought were rubbish or you felt really had it in for you?
There was Mr. Bennett from Hallgrove, and he was quite fun because He just didn't like me. I remember what I, there was one, it was like this really weird scenario that, that we were playing football in the garden before going to school. And we had doves at my folks' house. And we were playing garden. I'd throw myself in the goal or whatever, and I'd end up getting dove poo on my leg or whatever. It got pointed out to me, you've got poo in your leg in this classroom. And I was like, oh, so I got up and it just kind of got on the chair. And I was like, and he was like, would you go sort out your fucking, your poo all over you. And I was like, oh no, it's bird poo. It's not my mind. Anyway, and he was like, why are you gone and chat yourself in my class or whatever it is, and sent me off to the matron to go get sorted, right? And this chair that I had sat on sat outside the classroom that he had put out there in the outside for about 6 months afterwards. And every week we'd walk past, it was like, that was the chair that Woods, bloody Parks was a surname at that time, Woods chat himself on. I was like, it was just and so that became like, I became this butler's joke. It was a massive problem for me to such an extent that I actually ended up having to take this chair and throw it into the bushes so I would not be mocked every time I went past it. And he would remind me all the time of it. This is Ben. I was like,
wow,
you can't do this. You're bullying me. You're a bloody teacher. You got the thing out there. You're talking about this thing. And it was a real thing. That school was strange. There was Mr. Lovelock, who was upstairs.
What's a name?
He was Dirty Lovelock, and it was like he had this weird room that was up these tiny stairs in this small, you know, classroom that was above, you know, it was almost like one of those small, like rafted type classrooms up this sort of small staircase, wooden paneled everywhere, and those kind of tape desks with the ink wells in it, and they, you lift them up and you got your books underneath. And he used to call people little piggy. He said, this guy, Felix Page was my mate. He said, Pagus, you little piggy, come here. And you'd have to go to the top front of the desk. He'd say, why have you spelt this wrong, you little piggy? And we have this Holgrove reunion with some of the lads that we're in. And everybody keeps on reciting this. And it wasn't a one-off occasion. It was like, this guy was weird. And wow. You know, sometimes people will be left behind. Nobody's ever said that there was anything further more sinister than just some very weird phrasing. But I certainly was happy I was never kept behind after class.
It sounds a bit like Deliverance, squeal like a pig. It's pretty horrible, that. Now, I get to ask you this, which I don't get to ask many of my guests. You made it through to the final three of the 2015 series of The Apprentice. And it's fair to say that you encountered a few disciplinarians along the way in terms of people like Claude, Alan. I believe Karen would have been on there as well, Karen Brady. But obviously you went through the interview panel, which very few people get to do, of course. Who was the scariest and who do you think would have made the best head teacher and why?
Oh, well, the thing is, you watch The Apprentice before going on it, but you never think, 80,000 applications that go into it each year. And you turn up and it's like, when you do these applications, you turn up and it's like something off of the X Factor, massive rows and lines of people auditioning, waiting for their turn to go in and audition. Never thought in a million years that I'd join. I was almost going to turn around. I was like, what am I doing here? And before you know it, you kind of get through, and before, you know, you do two or three weekends of auditions, and then suddenly you get a phone call to say, look, we'd like to actually give you a pay, you know. And I knew that I got down to, you know, the last 30 or whatever, because they then do the final auditions and interviews and stuff with you before you even get in. So you've gone through all of that stuff as well. But the phone call is like, we're going to pick you up in a car in 2 weeks. Prepare your business plan. You're like, fucking, I've got a business like with like 10 people running, and I need to like get leave for 3 months in 2 weeks. So you have no time to do that business plan, rest of it. And so I'd kind of put it together. It was okay. It wasn't great. And I put it in, and I had done really well in all the tasks. I'd only lost one task. I kind of got a load of apprentice records, sold £4.5 million in space of 8 hours on one of those tasks, like fucking huge amounts of success through it. And then we get into these final interview stages, and I think, you know, I could see me and Sugar in a car together sailing off into the sunset. I thought I'd won it. And it was from there, it was just a case of just ticking a few boxes and be laughing. And from interviewer to interviewer, like, it was like getting punched in the... Everybody's got a plan to get punched in the face, Mike Tyson quote, right? Mm. And it was like getting slogged left, right, and center. And I was like, whoa, where did that come from? Because I think I'm Billy Big Balls going in there. And then suddenly people... the first person I went to was the Scottish guy. Mm. Forget his name. Anyway, and he does a load of due diligence on financials and, like, money stuff and like... ripped me apart on the numbers and stuff. I was like, so my business plan's crap, all right, fine. And I did that one badly. Then we went into this pit bull, Claude, who I'd been, obviously, he's been shadowing me the whole time. And I thought I'd built a rapport. And he just looks me in the eye and goes, I don't think you're the right man for Sugar. And I'm like, fuck, now you're telling me, like, from a general perspective, I'm not Sugar's man. So I've been sucker punched everywhere. And then get called up to the third person, Linda. And I sat down in front of Linda Plum.
I must admit, I actually rewatched this as my due diligence before doing this interview. And I was watching it going, fucking hell, that's brutal.
When you think about who would make a good headmistress,
I think she's the one. You know,
she, oh my God. So I walk in and I've been slapped about already. So I'm kind of like, fuck this thing. And I sit down and I start talking, and she asks me a question, you know, she starts off like, is the typical, like, butt you up before you slap me down, right? She says, I know you've done really well in the task. I was like, great. So she said that up front. It's beautifully done. Like, cause she just took every little positive that I ever had left. And she went, I know you did well in the past. Swipe that away. Right. So now, like, mentally I'm like, so now, and she's like, but this business plan is a load of shit, you know? And I just think it's a load, biggest load of waffle, a little bit more, you know? And she said, I think it's a load of bots. I think you're the sort of guy that can write a load of waffle and think people are going to consume it. Well, I don't, you know, it's bollocks or whatever she said. She was swearing on the bloody apprentice.
Yeah, she called it bullshit, as I recall.
Bullshit. She says bullshit. And I'm like that. And the thing is, I look at, I kick myself now because she's got my monthly figures, right? So remember, you know, I'm in my 20s and I'm going on to this show to be able to do investment, right? Most of the people in there haven't run their own business. I've got business with staff and I'm taking home a salary myself and I'm still making like 20, 30 grand a year in net profit. And I know that that's not good enough because I want to go and get this investment to go and do, you know, millions in turnover and hundreds of thousands in profit. So I know it's not good enough to make 10, 20, 30K net profit. And she goes and tells me, this is not good enough, you're crap, you couldn't do it. And I rewatched that going, fuck, I'm presenting 3 years annuals accounts with net profit making plus making it. That's a really good person to be invested in, not the bloke who's been on a management training program at Tesco's, who's then applying. Gary, I love him. He's a great guy, but he's applying. Or yeah. Joseph, the plumber who won, effectively was just a plumber and not just a plumber, it's an unfair thing to say, but he was just a sole trader who happened to be a plumber. And that was the business he did, and they expanded that. And I've got 3 years annuals accounts on this unique idea. And I just let her then start going, I think I agree with you. I think I agree. And she just took every last breath out of me. And I rolled straight out of those interviews, straight into the boardroom with Sugar. Sugar then slapped me about even more. And although he got rid of Gary and Charlene and stuff before me, I really should have made the final, like the last two. I really should have come third. I should have probably won it. But and I think that everybody in that boardroom was surprised at the person that came in after those interviews because I had already mentally checked out because I just was battered so much that it must be a weakness in my character that I'd mentally said that this is gone and I'd moved on from winning the show. And it's so stupid that sometimes you've got to lean in even more. When the building's on fire, you've got to sometimes run at it as opposed to run away from it. And I kind of had mentally checked out, which meant that Varna had kind of, she'd been fighting. I never hit a boardroom. That was the point. I never went into the boardroom with Sugar afterwards because I won every task except for one. And that was when everybody lost. Right. So it's kind of like I was amongst like eight people in the boardroom all arguing. So I'd never been in one of those like three people in the boardroom fighting for their place a bit. Varna had been in there who came second. She'd been in there like week after week after week. So she just rolled her sleeves up and just fought like she'd always fought. And I'm kind of there just licking my wounds still, going, fucking, what just happened? Like spinning around like as if I've just got concussion. And you know, she fought for it more than me. And I just fucked it up basically. So gutted, still regret that situation. But it just goes to show that's the stresses that it puts people under, and high stress environments, people can thrive, and people can kind of, you know, people that are doing well can melt. And I thought I'd be someone that would thrive, but obviously when the heat what turned up then, I melted, unfortunately.
I'm surprised that you didn't pull a knife on her. That might have changed things slightly.
Yeah, that's a strong education this world needs, hey?
Rich, my last question to you is an open-ended one, and you can be as glib and short as you like, or you can riff on it for as long as you like. If you could meet the 16-year-old you and all that would entail, as you are now, knowing what you know, achieving what you've achieved, what would you say to him?
Invest in Apple.
And BrewDog.
All of them. There's a few that you should stick a couple of quid into, see what happens. Things will be all right, Rich. Couple of quid into Apple shares, you'll be fine, my friend. That's what I'd say. I don't know. I think the point is that your experiences shape you, but I've sweat the small stuff way too much in times, and sometimes you've got to look up and enjoy things, but also I've kind of over enjoyed life sometimes as well. So there's a little bit of, you know, critique from, so it's kind of a blend, isn't it, really? This the you gotta, yeah, it's such a hard question, that, because, you know, I don't know if I'd want to turn out any differently. That's the point, because the journey's not there yet. I may end up being an absolute freaking hero. And so if I cook it up now, I could be Joe, on an amazing path to become an absolute legend. And so I don't want to mess it up.
You mean you're not there already? Come on now, have some faith.
They're going to have statues of me.
In Windlesham, I think that would be a great statue.
That is my claim to fame. Yeah. Claim to fame. So I turned on the Christmas lights in Windlesham.
Brilliant.
As a person of notoriety.
You made it when you're there. Rich, thank you so much for agreeing to be a guest on my podcast. If people want to look you up and your business and everything else, would you mind dropping a few social media handles in this section?
Don't waste your time, guys. I'll find you. Yeah, $1 million sprint. That's what I do. I help business owners go from some revenue to a million revenue. $1 million sprint.com.
Excellent. And if you do want to ever watch the Apprentice 2015 highlights, Rich is very, very good in the task, especially in the kitchen. He ruled the kitchen with an iron fist, as I seem to recall. Yeah. And if you, maybe try not to watch the scenes of him getting fisted in the boardroom. It's particularly unedifying. And he was hard done by, as I always said at the time.
Yeah. It's like, hear.
Rich, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
If you wish to support the pod, you can find me on Twitter at SchooliesPod, or just search Right in the Schoolies. And that's the same for Instagram, Right in the Schoolies, under the name Mr. James. Your homework is, of course, as ever, to give me some lovely reviews and some nice feedback. If you know of anybody who you think would want to be on our pod, be they well-known or lesser well-known, but you think that they have some good stories to tell, then get in touch on my social media. Class dismissed.